Nonetheless, we're now up to the sheets that you have in front of you and the questions of why are we here? Meaning, what is the purpose of the universe? What is the purpose of the human being in the universe? And really, if you're going to try to do this as an overview of what does Kabbalah say about this topic, it's impossible. Meaning, there are so many different streams within Kabbalah that you'll never make it to first base in this conversation. So what I want to do is pick one approach, and it's the approach of Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin, who I mentioned earlier, as I mentioned him last week as well, the head and founder of the great yeshiva that was in Volozhin. Remember, we had the discussion about the pin test last week. That was his yeshiva. And I pick him for two reasons. Number one, because he wrote a work called Nefesh HaChayim, which you can see, I translated excerpts of, most of this page is just translations of what he wrote. So he put it down in writing in a relatively clear way, pretty clear as Kabbalah goes. That's number one. And number two, because he anchors what he has to say in older Jewish sources, which for me gives it a stamp of authenticity that I like and that I feel comfortable with, as opposed to somebody who says, well, here's what I believe, and doesn't present anything that anchors it in a chain of tradition. So his is the approach that I want to take to these questions of what is the purpose of the universe, what is the purpose of the human being. So first, in order to do this, you have to meet God. Right? What is God? Who is God? What does God want? Why did God create this world? So we always have trouble in Judaism when it comes to describing God. Right? Why do we have trouble describing God?
We're supposed to be omnipotent. We can't explain things that are omnipotent.
Right? God is supposed to be omnipotent, unlimited.
Can't see him.
Invisible, infinite. These are things that we have a lot of trouble describing. That's for sure. The biggest one, though, no one's mentioned it yet, is the problem of there being one God. Now, you'll say, well, what's so hard about that? At this point, you know, much of the world, certainly much of the world that believes that there is a God, believes that there's one. So, really, is this such a hard concept? However, the way that Judaism classically has understood the unity of God is that one, omnipotent, omniscient, also means unchanging, ungrowing. There is no evolution of God. God doesn't develop. God isn't different one day than he was the day before because he's perfect. And if he's perfect, he doesn't need to change. Now, in order to really unpack that, you need a whole lot of philosophy that puts me to sleep. No, what I meant to say was, there's a lot that goes into this vision of what God is. But there's a great fear that once you describe God in any way, shape, or form, you are already limiting God. If you describe God as learning something new, boy, are you in trouble. How could that be? God is omniscient. He must have known before. If you describe God as being angry, what do you mean? Anger is a frailty. Anger is a human trait. It's an emotion. How does God have such frailties? Even to describe God as strong is a problem because that implies a spectrum of strength. In which, you know, I'm down here and God is way up there, but there's some kind of relationship and I could work my way towards where God is. God is supposed to be off the charts, off the scales. How can I use the same terms that I use to describe human beings to also describe God? Classically, when you look back at biblical text, you find a limited set of adjectives that are used to describe God. And that's basically it. And when you look at the Siddur, when you look at liturgy, and you see the terms that are used to describe God, invariably, they draw on the terms that are used in biblical text. They don't add new ones. They look to the biblical text as justification. Well, if Moshe can describe God in this way, I guess it's okay for us to do so. There's a story told in the Talmud about someone who gets up to lead services, and he starts the Amidah. And he starts with the traditional wording of Hakel, Hagadol, Hagibor, VaHanora, that God is the mighty, the powerful, the awesome. And then he starts adding more descriptions of God. And there's a sage sitting there, probably looking at his watch. And when this fellow finishes, he says, "Are you done now? That's it? You finished describing God? By what right do you add? Once you're going to add, you have to say everything. We work with what Moses said. We don't start inventing additional, because if you invent additional, you are responsible for it." So there's this aversion to stating descriptions of God. And instead, the Maimonidean approach, classically, was to try to describe God in one of three ways. To describe God based on his impact, how we experience God. So, for example, I'm walking along on the street and I find a $20 bill on the ground. I say, "Oh, God is merciful." Somebody else walking down the street realizes he had a hole in his pocket and that's how he lost $20. And he says, "Oh, God is just and he's punishing me." Right, for the same event. We describe God based on our experience of God. Second, Maimonides says, describe God based on what God is not. So, he's not weak. He's not mean. He's not whatever it is. Whatever you believe God is not, that's your description. And then, describe God as the greatest of whatever positive trait you can come up with. That's what Maimonides suggests are the safe ways to describe God. Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin, if you take a look at source number one, says the following. All of the translations you're going to see, unless I marked it otherwise, are like in number two. Other than that, are from me. All errors are mine as well. Names and descriptions and attributes for God all express God's linkage to the worlds and their forces from the time of creation, supporting them and invigorating them and orchestrating them as he desires. According to the changes in the orders of his orchestration, the names and descriptions change. Each specific element of his orchestration has its own name and description. Did anyone understand that? Anyone said yes, I'd be very impressed. The English translation needs a translation. What Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin is trying to say is that whenever you see a name of God appear in biblical text or later, what it is describing is not God, but God's relationship with the universe. The way in which God, as I've translated it here, supports, invigorates, and orchestrates things. The description is not who God is, but what is God doing to the universe. So I gave the example of finding the $20 bill and saying God is merciful. That's a simple and small example. But if I were to envision God as, let's say, providing or sending rain. I describe God as sending rain. That's a very simple and low-level example of it. God is the one who nourishes the plants and so on. That would fit this idea of describing God's link with this world. They deal with it generally on a more abstract level. God sends certain forces, and we'll see what those forces are, which are the forces that ultimately will activate the rain to take place in this world. This is God's orchestration and supervision of the world, and that's the way that he envisions describing God's influence. And he has two different types of influence that we're going to emphasize. One is God as creator, and the other is God as orchestrator or governor. The creation, of course, is outlined in the Torah. Right? The biblical text tells us something about God creating the universe. But it has a problem. Well, there are a whole host of problems with creation. 6 days, 13 billion years, and so forth. There are a lot of problems with creation. But one of the problems that really caught the attention of the mystics is the problem of, if there wasn't a universe before, if it was just God, then when the universe took up space, where did God go? In other words, if God is everything, if nothing exists besides God in the beginning, then how is there space for there to be a universe? Symptom is where we're going. Good. We have to understand what that means. That's exactly where we're going. You follow the question? Honestly, it doesn't keep me up at night. But when you're a philosopher, right, whether you're a philosopher of debate or of a received tradition, it's the sort of thing that you think about. So they wanted to know, how can I believe in this system that on the one hand tells me God was everything, and God can't be reduced, he can't shrink, and yet somehow now there's room for there to be a universe. That's the challenge. So the mystics come up with the idea of Tzimtzum. Take a look at number 2, please. This is from the beginning of Sefer Yetzirah, that book of creation that we talked about, as translated and commented on by Rabbi Aryeh Kaplan. Just the opening quote there. With 32 paths engraved, Ka, the Lord of hosts, dot, dot, dot. Ka is a name for God. Yud, hey. Because biblical text prohibits writing the name of God on something and then throwing it out, that's why I changed it in writing, so I didn't write it. It would be literally written YAH, would be the English transliteration of it. I changed it instead. That's what's traditionally done. Look at Rabbi Aryeh Kaplan's commentary on this one introduction, which says that God engraved 32 paths. He says, to understand why the author uses the term engraved here, we must first understand the idea of creation. Before a universe could be created, empty space had to exist in which it could be made. But initially only God existed, and all existence was filled with the divine essence, the light of the infinite. In Hebrew it's called Or Ein Sof. Or meaning light, Ein Sof, the infinite. It was out of this undifferentiated essence that a vacated space had to be engraved. You got to make room for the world. The process, known to Kabbalists as Tzimtzum, which he translates as constriction, is clearly described in the Zohar. I like that phrase, clearly described in the Zohar. That's an oxymoron. But okay, in the beginning of the king's authority, the lamp of darkness engraved a hollow in this supernal luminescence. See, it was clearly described. Wow. He's right. I retract. He says, the lamp of darkness engraved a hollow in the supernal luminescence. What in the world does that mean? So, Rabbi Chaim of Halajin offers us some level of explanation in number 3. Tzimtzum is not an expression of removal and travel from one place to another as though God were withdrawing into himself, as though such a thing were possible, to make space for us, God forbid. He says, don't think that this means that God moved from point A to point B or shrunk himself somehow. Rather, he says, it expresses hiding and covering. Tzimtzum does not mean shrinking. Tzimtzum means being less visible, is the idea. It's sort of like parenting, in a sense. In other words, as your children grow older, you have to, at a certain point, stop making their world. You can watch. You can think. Depending on your child, you might even be able to offer some advice if you word it in the right way. But fundamentally, you have to engage in Tzimtzum. Tzimtzum doesn't mean you're not there, but it means that you're less visible in terms of your hand in what's going on. And that's the way Rabbi Chaim Volozhin envisions the process of creation. God is still everywhere, including within the universe that he has created. Everything around us somehow, and don't ask me beyond the word somehow, but somehow is part of God, but the godliness in it is not visible. That's the way that he explains this idea of God as creator. But not only is God creator, he is also orchestrator. He makes things happen. And here we get into what are called the Sfirot. Show of hands, how many people have heard of Sfirot before? Okay, so we have some familiarity with it here. The term Sfirot refers to a concept in which the universe is governed not by impersonal forces, the law of gravity or something along those lines, but rather that God actually has certain ways in which He influences the world, sending it light, sending it the energy by which it functions, and these are the channels. Each channel is called a sphera. The origin of the term sphera, I see the attendance thing is going around. You don't actually need to check off that you're here. I didn't want to confuse things with that. The purpose of the list is only that in the event that you see your name is not on the list, and especially if you didn't receive the email with the source sheets in advance, then make sure that you add your name and email address. You don't need to actually, you know, check off. It's nice to know you're here, but I don't want to make everybody have to do that. I just assume you're here. No, the term sphera is of somewhat questionable origin. One approach that I've seen is that sphera comes from the word sapir. Sapir meaning sapphire. Because if you remember at Sinai, when the Jews witness God, whatever that means, v'tachat raglav k'maaseh livnat ha-sapir, and beneath his feet, so to speak, beneath the divine throne, is something like a sapphire surface. So the sphera would be this emanation of, this influence of the sapir. Possibly. Gershom Scholem suggests that it's actually from the word mispar. What is mispar in Hebrew?
Number.
Number. And the idea is that God is one unity, and these influences are plural. They're different from God. These are the plural ways in which God influences our world. I think that's as good an explanation as any. But this is the way God powers the world. If you take a look at source number 4, Rabbi Chaim of Elazhin says, God expands and is hidden within all of the spherot, and He fills them. He is their soul, as if it were possible. Like a soul expands and is hidden in the body of a person. He's going to keep on saying, as it were, and as if it were possible, because all of these things are just approximations using language that wasn't designed to ultimately express these concepts. But what he's saying is that there are forces that God uses to animate the world, to make this world exist, and each one has its own unique identity, even personality, so to speak, and that God is creating and sending these constantly. Now, one of the things that the idea of Sphirot helps us with is to bridge the gap between God and this world. Shirley was here. Where's Shirley Austin? There you are. So Shirley sent me an article that was in the Boston Globe last few days about a new translation of the Zohar called the Pritzker edition of the Zohar. You can go online, you can find the article, maybe I'll send out the link when I send out the audio link later. But in it they mention this point. We have a fundamental problem. If you envision God as so separate from a physical realm, that He has no physicality, He's infinite, He's always been there, He's always going to be there, omniscient and so on, you sort of need to explain how can there can be any sort of intersection between a God like that and our very physical world. And so the idea of the Sphirot is that it demonstrates the bridge, how God is sending light to this world. I should note the idea of emanations that God is sending and so forth is not only found within Judaism. You find it in Greek thought as well, right? In Platonic thought, you will find the same type of an idea. It's not unique to us. The question of who started it is not one I'm going to leave. I'm not going to get myself into trouble with that one. The problem with Sphirot is that they can lead to a potential misunderstanding of what God is and what God is not. For starters, because it can cause people to think of God as being multiple. Meaning, one of the Sphirot is called Hod. Hod, which means glory, is often associated with humility. Another of the Sphirot is called Malchut. Malchut meaning? Monarchy, right. Royalty. which seems to convey, although there are a lot of layers to this, but it seems to convey God as majesty. Majesty on the one hand, humility on the other hand. So which one is God? Is God lofty up on a throne? Or is God humble? A gem has facets, and we're calling them sapphire, that helps. Perhaps, yes, there was someone else? There are ways of addressing it, but one of the fears with Sfirot is that people come to associate them with God and ultimately say, well, there must be multiple gods, or God must change. Another challenge is the idea that maybe what I'm looking for is a particular benefit, maybe I should focus on that and pray to that. And that's actually been a concern. Take a look at source number 5. Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin once again. He describes something from the book of Kavanot of Rabbi Yitzhak Luria. He says, when the Kavanot records to focus on a particular Kavana for a particular Sfira in each blessing, when Rabbi Luria said that you should have a particular idea in mind when you say this blessing, that doesn't mean, God forbid, that one should intend for the actual Sfira. That you should actually go for that. In other words, I'm only thinking about that, and that's my God when I say this. That would be what he calls a cutting of the growth, God forbid. That's a phrase we saw last week when we talked about the four sages who went into Pardes, and one of them left Judaism, and the phrase used was cutting of the growth. He says that would be abandoning Judaism at that point. To focus on a particular force or sphera would be a desecration. Rather, only to the essence of the one master, the blessed Ein Sof, infinite unity of all forces. So there's a lot of fear involved with invoking the Sfirot, but this gives us a little bit of a sense of what Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin thinks God is and is not. God is the creator. He engaged in Tzimtzum, which means that he hides himself, but he's a part of all that exists. You just can't see it. He's also the ongoing orchestrator, sending forces by which different aspects of the universe are strengthened and maintained. I would ask if that's clear, but I don't think I want to know the answer. I don't think I want to know, and I don't think I want a yes. Now we meet the universe. Now that we have some sense of what we're portraying as God, what is the universe itself? So here we revert to the Zohar. Take a look at source number 6. When King Solomon went down into the depth of the nut, a nut as in a vision, a nut with shells, that's what we mean. As it is written, and he quotes me from Shir HaShirim, Song of Songs, I went down into the nut garden. He took the shell of a nut and examined all the shells, and knew that all the delights of the other side in the Zohar is a negative thing. The other side is like dark side in the Star Wars universe. Sitra Achra is the term in Aramaic. All the delights promised by the other side, the shells of the nut, consisted only in cleaving to men and defiling them. In other words, pursuits of pleasure that are part of this, I don't even know what to call it, other side, try to defile the human being. All, meaning the universe, consists of an inner kernel with several shells covering the kernel. And the whole world is constructed according to this pattern, above and below. From the mysterious beginning of the highest point down to the lowest of all levels, it is all one within the other, one within the other, so that we find that one level is the shell of another, and this other the shell of another. What he's saying is, it's layers all the way down. The universe is constructed in layers within layers, the outermost being the highest in terms of its spirituality, and then working its way down to where we are, where we have the least influence of that spirituality. And Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin says, take a look at number 7, each world functions according to the pull of the force in the world above it, which leads it as the soul leads the body. So it goes higher and higher until God, who is the soul of all. So in Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin's vision, the outermost realms are actually the ones that are closest to God. They have the strongest influence from God, which then percolates down through the layers until it gets to us. However, it's not one directional. Here he says something that I really don't know what to do with, but I present it to you in the interest of authenticity. Take a look at number 8. He says it can actually go the other way too, and he talks about a malach. Malach is an angel, right? We've discussed that in various classes at various times. Malach meaning melacha, something that does a task. It is created to perform a task. So he writes, a malach is greater than a human being, whether in its essential nature, or its great holiness, or the wonder of its perception. There is no comparison. He says a malach is beyond a human being. Now remember, those who have heard from me, Maimonides expands the idea of a malach and says anything that God uses to carry out a task is a malach. It can be human, it can be inanimate, it can be a drop of rain. That's not what Rabbi Chaim of Elazhin is talking about here. He's talking about spiritual beings created by God, which are greater than human beings in terms of the purity of their nature, their holiness, what it can perceive. However, in one way, a person has an advantage over a malach in the elevation and joining of the worlds and forces and illuminations. The elevation of the angel to his position to join with the world above him is not dependent upon himself. This is why malachim are described as stationary. We read last week, from the beginning of Ezekiel, Yechezkel, it said that the malach has one leg. He says the idea of having one leg is that it's stuck wherever it is. A malach cannot move. These spiritual forces have no ability to move themselves. How then do they move? How do the forces go from one realm to another, one shell to another? Only human beings elevate, join, and unify worlds and illuminations through their deeds. For human beings include elements of all. As a result of a person's deeds, the angel receives elevation and added holiness. I meant to write malach there too. The malach receives elevation and added holiness. In other words, what he's suggesting is, the force that God sends goes from outside and then works its way inward to our world, but we are the ones who trigger it. With our actions here, we enable that force to actually travel to this world. For anyone who came last week and was disappointed that we spent our entire time on history instead of actually talking about what Kabbalah actually says, I hope you're happy now. I understand less, but nonetheless, that's what he envisions the world. It's a very human-centric view of the world, right? In contrast to Maimonidean ideas, where Maimonides says, you know, angels exist, including spiritual beings, and we aren't their purpose. They have some other purpose in the world that has nothing to do with us. As far as Rabbi Chaim of Elazhin explains, and it's not only him, it's a huge school of Kabbalah, everything in the universe is running because of us. We are the engine. We are the ones who enable through our deeds, and we'll talk about which deeds soon, but through our deeds, we cause everything to run. Which brings us to our next question, which is, okay, I now get that God is the creator of all, and that God is the orchestrator of all, through these forces. I now understand that the universe is supposed to be layer upon layer upon layer, each outer layer being more spiritual and closer to God, and that there are forces that are being drawn from God to support them, and that I somehow am responsible for that. That brings us to the question, so why are we here? What is it that human beings are meant to do to achieve this end? So, that requires that we discuss the soul. What a human soul is. Take a look, please, at source number 9. We clearly are not going to finish the entire page today, so that will just lead into next week. It's like the cliffhangers. Right, so I don't have the option of adding a lecture, unfortunately. But well, let's see what we get through. So Rabbi Chaim of Elazhin talks about three words. Nefesh, Ruach, and Neshama. Neshama is probably the most familiar. What is a neshama?
Soul.
A soul. It comes from the word neshima. What is neshima? Breath. Breath, exactly. It's what God breathes into the human being initially. Ruach literally is wind, often used for spirit as well. And nephesh is a term that has many possible meanings, but one of them, again, is soul. We saw it last week when we talked about Abraham and Sarah potentially making souls, making nefashot. So these are aspects of the human soul. And as Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin outlines it, it's actually a hierarchy. He says the nefesh is the lowest level, entirely within a person's body. It is the most physical aspect of the soul. The ruach is poured in from above. Its upper extreme is tied above in the lowest level of the neshama. And it descends into the person's body where it links to the upper extreme of the nefesh. But the neshama is the breath itself, hidden in its inner nature, and its blessed source is, as if it were possible, in the breath of the divine mouth. Its essence does not enter a person's body at all. Do you understand what he's saying? Really? I thought now this was the easy part. What he's trying to say is that there is a, just as the universe has layer upon layer, it's like an onion, right? Just like the universe has layer upon layer, the soul also has layer upon layer. And that there is a hierarchy within, and that each layer is in contact with the next one down. The nefesh being the most earthly of them, the ruach being outer from that, and the neshama being outer from that. And that it's all part of this chain of connection to God. And each part itself, he says, I didn't bring it on the sheet, but each part of this is going to be made up of sub-levels also. So that's the way he views the soul, just like the world. The world is this hierarchy, and the soul of the human being is as well. And so what we have to do then next time is to talk about how this repairing of the world, as the phrase goes, as well as energizing of the world, is engineered by the human being. So God willing, that's what we will start with next time. Again, I should note, as